from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, wildfires unleash more than flames. They create smoke-filled skies full of particles that can be especially harmful to older people, children, and people with chronic illnesses. The fires can trigger anxiety, fear, and other strong emotions, particularly among survivors of previous catastrophic wildfires. In this hour Forum, we talk with health experts and a former firefighter about the physical and mental strain of wildfires and how to cope. That's all next on Forum. Join us after this news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. Smoke will linger in the air today across much of the Bay Area with officials issuing alerts. So just how dangerous is wildfire smoke and what can you do to protect yourself and loved ones? That smoke-filled haze, along with images of homes consumed by flames, are also triggering memories of previous deadly and destructive fires, especially among fire survivors. And some are having to flee their homes again. In this hour Forum, we want to hear how you're doing as we take stock of the physical and emotional toll these wildfires are having on Bay Area residents and first responders. The number to call with your stories is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, email us at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website. We're joined by Dr. Sarah Metz. She's Division Director of Trauma Recovery Services at UCSF Trauma Recovery Center. Good morning, Dr. Sarah Metz.
Good morning.
We're also joined by Dr. Mary Prunicki, Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research at Stanford University. Hello, Dr. Mary Prunicki.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. And I'd like to start with you. We have had a lot of questions from listeners about the dangers of wildfire smoke, and I wanted to try and address some of them. What first can you tell us is in wildfire smoke? What are the components that are particularly harmful to people?
Well, we typically focus on particulate matter because 80% of wildfire smoke is particulate matter. And we know that if the particulate matter, PM2.5, is small enough that it can go deep into the lungs and cross into the bloodstream. So that, in particular, is what we follow during wildfires.
And so if structures are burning, is there a particular concern that there are more than just, say, the kind of particulates and ash that come from trees or wood?
Exactly, because, you know, the actual composition of particulate matter varies from source to source. There is a particular fear that when, you know, structures are burning and you're having plastics being burned and chemicals, in the fire, that particulate matter is more toxic to the human body than, for say, during an actual wildfire in the forest.
And so what are the health impacts, both short and potentially long term?
Well, we know that when there is increased wildfire smoke exposure, you're going to get an increase in respiratory and cardiovascular outcomes. So you're going to see an increase in emergency room and hospital admissions for things like asthma, COPD, pneumonia, acute bronchitis, and then also for cardiovascular diseases like heart attacks, arrhythmias, and strokes. The people most impacted are the very young children, so ages 0 to 4, especially for respiratory disorders, and then the elderly, so those greater than 65 are more at risk, for example, for heart attacks. And then those with pre-existing cardiovascular and respiratory disorders are particularly at risk.
Can you give us a definitive answer on whether or not masks of N95 or P100, of masks that are known as these types, that they're effective in filtering out these kinds of particulates?
Well, they are effective. However, they have to be fitted properly. And also, you know, it you have to be able to wear them. And some people who have chronic diseases need to consult with their doctors to see if they should actually be wearing them. So, for example, if you have facial hair, if you have a beard, it will not fit properly. You also have to know how to keep the seal. And then, of course, for children, the masks are typically, you know, too big, and it's hard to keep the seal. So they do filter the particles, provided they're worn correctly and that the person wearing them is okay breathing through the mask.
Are they actually better than nothing, though? Or there was some suggestion that even having them on and giving yourself the sense that you're protected could be more harmful than good if they're not on.
I think it could be
properly.
More harmful if you increase your exposure to the wildfire smoke because you have a false sense of security. So if you have to be out, it would be better to have them on. But if you can stay indoors and keep your windows closed and have your air purifier or, you know, your HEPA filters going, that's certainly preferable.
Right, though you can't get your HEPA filters going frequently because you don't have power. That was one thing that a lot of residents have come up against.
Completely true.
And then the other thing, too, is that, you know, we've kind of used masks as a way of trying to deal with people who do have to work outdoors and for them to be able to deal with the particulates that are in the air. I mean, right now, where I live, it's the peak of crush or grape harvest. And already, you know, people have been out trying to get the grapes in before there's smoke damage. And there were regulations that were put in place during the previous wildfire that basically had advocates saying that employers must provide these masks. But it really sounds like what you're basically saying is that these masks, unless they're very uncomfortable and probably a little bit hard to breathe through, are really not that effective.
Well, I mean, they certainly do filter the particles, but you do have the problems with the seal, and also, you know, who really should be having them on. So it's a hard question to answer.
Yes. So do you feel like there just need to be more regulations around working indoors, or staying indoors and not having folks do the work?
There's more and more research coming out regarding wildfires showing that, you know, short-term exposure can cause harm. And so I think as more research comes out, perhaps we'll see that there should be stricter policies with exposure.
Well, the smoke, in addition to causing concerns about you know, lungs and about what you're breathing in, it's also causing Dr. Sarah Metz triggers, I guess, for people who have survived previous wildfires. For example, we have Beth who writes in and says, 4 years ago in the Amador Calaveras counties, we had the historic Butte fire. Our home was saved, but the smell of smoke stops me in my tracks and makes me immediately check on my older neighbors. Now, with no power since Saturday, I will just start crying uncontrollably out of the blue. 4 years of stress. What is Beth experiencing?
I think a really normal and common reaction to somebody who's experienced a really traumatic and scary event in their life.
And so what is a normal initial response when all of this is going on? Smoke is filling the air. You know, some people might see flames in the distance.
Yeah, I mean, it can really run the gamut. I think fear, anxiety are all extremely normal. You know, some people tend to have more outward expressions, so they might look a little bit more agitated, a little bit more anxious, irritable, angry. Other folks can sometimes kind of go inwards, and so they look a little bit more disconnected, shut down, maybe a little bit emotionally numb. During this acute stage, folks can kind of experience something similar to like a tunnel vision, where they're feeling really dazed. It's really difficult for them to hold new information. They might be a little bit disoriented in terms of time and place, and just, you know, kind of spacey, maybe even almost feeling disconnected from themselves.
And so how can you support people who are going through sort of the immediate initial emotional response of a fire?
I mean, I think the first thing is you know, their physical safety and really trying to get them physically safe. In terms of their emotional health, you know, I think having support systems around them, if there's folks that can help kind of get their basic needs met and creature comforts, that can really just be helpful and nurturing to them. As I said, you know, folks can really vary in terms of their response, and so their needs are going to be really different. And so I think it's also important to ask each person what they need. You know, at the immediate, some folks might really want to engage and talk about how they're feeling and what's going on. As I said, some folks might want to be a little bit more quiet. So I think respecting what their preferences and needs are. But I think also educating folks about normal reactions to trauma is really important. One of the things that can happen is folks will frequently reflect that they feel like they're going crazy or something's wrong with them, when in fact they're having completely normal reactions to a really scary life event.
Well, we've got calls coming in. I want to go to Erica in San Rafael. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
Hi. Join us. What's on your mind?
I live in San Rafael. And I just wanted to say we've been doing okay with power out, kind of like camping. But now that we're on our fourth day, when we go into the grocery stores, there's not really any more food. Like, my dad, he works in the city, and today he's going to have to go to a Safeway over there to bring home some food. So it's just getting a little crazier, and with the communication being down, I had to go and check physically if my school was open today at College of Marin. There's not really a lot of information going around.
Erica, thanks for sharing that. Sarah Mitz, can you talk about how the power outage could be compounding the stresses that people are feeling, and what's really at work there? I wonder if it's this sense of just a lack of control.
I mean, absolutely, in many ways, right? So their environment is totally out of control. As she's mentioning, there's lack of communication, so there's questions, there's ambiguity, there's no known outcome that's going to happen. And so, yeah, I mean, it's their life is completely, you know, turned over. Their physical health is being impacted in multiple ways, you know, air quality, as was mentioned earlier, but then also potentially not eating as often, not eating as healthy of foods, access to clean water. You know, all of those things can absolutely increase stress level.
Let's go next to Alexa in Lafayette. Hi, Alexa.
Hi. So I'm originally from Santa Barbara County and grew up there in the late 80s and early 90s and have deeply ingrained fire alarm system in my body, where if I see yellowish light, I'm very aware of what's going on. And I moved around a lot in the country and have used Twitter since about 2008. I set it up so that I could track fires that were causing my family to be evacuated in Santa Barbara. And since moving back up here to the Bay Area, I've added a lot more information of meteorologists and firefighters and all of these people. And on Sunday, I spent all day without power, using up my battery, monitoring things. And it was both incredibly comforting and probably pretty stress-causing as well, to have all of this information, but at least to know what was going on around me. And I was getting information on Twitter about the fires in Lafayette 15 minutes before we got the Nixle alert and the Pulse Point alert. So it's a really wonderful resource, but I also know that it can be a lot of information to take in and not necessarily, you know, information that you need, because it's a lot.
Yes, that's a really good point, Alexa. I mean, what should people be on the lookout for when they're feeling sort of that information overload? And it's really information that sometimes they can't really do anything about.
Yeah. Is that for me? I think the caller said it perfectly. It's really both and. So it's both comforting because you're getting information, and it's also really triggering. And so I think folks need to find a balance for themselves. You know, if they're starting to feel overwhelmed, that could be an indication to take a break, turn the phone off, you know, take some deep breaths, you know, get regrounded, reminding yourself of things that you do have control over, of the information that you found to be reassuring, to kind of remind yourself of what that is. And, you know, as best you can, kind of filter out the unnecessary, but it absolutely can heighten anxiety, even though the goal was to decrease anxiety.
We're taking stock of the emotional and physical toll of wildfires, and we want to ask you, our listeners, how you are holding up What are your questions for our guests about how to support loved ones or how to keep you and your loved ones safe as wildfire smoke travels through the region? Are you a fire survivor? Is the Kincade Fire bringing things up for you, stirring strong emotions? And where are you turning right now for strength? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your questions or comments on Facebook, Twitter, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We're joined by Dr. Sarah Metz, Division Director of Trauma Recovery Services at UCSF Trauma Recovery Center, and Dr. Mary Prunicki, Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research at Stanford. And we're also joined now by Laura Clivens, who's a community health reporter for KQED. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
I wanted to bring you into the conversation because I know you have talked to people who have survived previous fires and are going through a lot as a result of this latest fire. Can you tell us who you've talked with?
Yeah, so I went up to Paradise 3 weeks ago to follow up with folks up there. The anniversary of that fire, the campfire, is coming up in just a few weeks. And so we will be doing some coverage around that. I spoke specifically to a few different people up there, and I want to focus in on one of them. Her name's Sabrina Haynes. She was a person that I focused in on because I was doing research on people who'd been through child trauma. And I met her and I followed her around in her life before the campfire even happened. And she had put together this system for maintaining her sort of homeostasis, this nice equilibrium in her life. And the campfire completely destroyed all that. She was based in Paradise and set up a lot of supports there. So now things have looked really different this past year. She is the single mom to a daughter named Aurora. And here is how she's described her feelings from last year.
Not being able to focus, not being able to concentrate. I am so spaced all the time, and I don't know what I'm doing half the time. Aurora will constantly be like, Mom, don't you remember you were going to do this for me? Oh, yeah, that's right. I don't feel like myself anymore. And that's, like, been the hardest thing. Losing what you thought life was going to be.
Losing what you thought life was going to be. Sarah Metz, can you help us understand what's behind that sentence?
Yeah, it's a common reaction that happens after trauma, which is, you know, we all go through life and we, you know, predict as best we can what the future is going to hold, what our identity is. And when trauma comes in, it can really disrupt that. It shakes your sense of yourself in the world, you know, as she was describing. It shakes up your sense of safety, of predictability. And so how you perceived yourself, other people, and the world is completely rocked.
Well, let's go to Judith in Oakland. Hi, Judith.
I just wanted to ask the doctor about, I'm having a lot of trouble with my eyes from the smoke and just using over-the-counter, Refresh, but it's not helping. And any comments on that would be much appreciated.
Judith, thank you. Mary Prunicki.
Yes. Are your symptoms alleviated if you can get where the air quality is improved, or is it consistent?
Oh, I'm staying in my house. I have a blood cancer. I'm on chemo, so I'm one of those people that has to be super safe. So I have just been staying inside, but I'm still having trouble, you know, with my eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very common because the particulate matter is such an irritant to have problems with tearing and with irritation. Saline drops may be helpful, but it may be useful to talk to your ophthalmologist and see what they can recommend.
Well, Judith, thanks for the question. I'm going to go next to Linda in San Francisco. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good morning. Also, people keep saying that the best thing of all as far as the smoke is to be indoors in a place where the windows and doors are well sealed. My apartment happens to be really drafty, and I know that there's, you know, not in the foreseeable future is that going to change, and I'm sure a lot of people are in the same boat. So does it help to be indoors if it's drafty indoors?
Linda, thank you. Mary Prunicki.
Yes, I mean, we always talk about outdoor air pollution, but there's also indoor air pollution. And when you do have an older or drafty home, that is certainly a problem. One solution might be a portable air purifier to help with the indoor air pollution, but it's a very real problem. And in certain homes, it's the particulate matter is too high indoors as well as outdoors.
Well, Jeffrey asks, can you please recommend which home air filter removes particulates that are specific to our Bay Area air? I live in San Francisco. If I don't smell smoke, can I open my windows to ventilate my apartment? Dr. Mary Pernicki.
There are different portable air purifiers that certainly do work, and you can go to certain websites where they will recommend, based on the size of your home or your room sizes, what would be best for you. One resource is the California Air Resources Board has a handout on air purifiers, and so that may be helpful going to such a site to choose an air purification unit. If you do have central air, HEPA air filters, provided that they're being replaced when necessary, are certainly effective.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey, for that comment. Going now to Sean in Healdsburg. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you?
Oh, we're holding up. We're actually dispersed all over the Bay Area right now. My family and I evacuated from the Chalk Hill area several days ago. And my question really is about how to support younger children through something like this. We went through the 2017 fires, but this one got a lot closer to our house. We saw a video of our house actually being defended by firefighters on the news, which was quite an experience.
Yeah.
And I have two daughters, one 6 and one 11, who are both experiencing very different emotional reactions to this. Our youngest one getting very clingy and our oldest getting kind of angry and acting out a bit more. And I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what the best way to really help them through this process is, given the reality of the situation.
Well, thanks for sharing your experience. Sarah Metz, any thoughts for Sean?
Yeah, so I just want to acknowledge I'm an expert in adult care, but for children, there's wonderful resources on the National Child Traumatic Stress Network website if you have access to the internet. Again, I think both of your children's reactions are very normal. I don't know. It sounds like you've had – this is their second fire, so I don't know if you saw some of this happening with the first and if their responses kind of shifted over time and if this is reactivating. But I would really highly encourage you to go to the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. It's important to talk with children at age-appropriate levels about what's happening, about their safety, reassuring them that you're going to keep them safe, that right now you're in a safe place. I think acknowledging for them, if what they're feeling, if they're feeling scared or angry, and you might need to just have a little bit more cuddle time with them too.
Is trying to also reestablish some semblance of normalcy helpful? We just have 20 seconds, but one of the things that we did when the power went out, and we typically have pancakes or donuts as a treat, one of those days we went out and tried to find a donut shop again.
Absolutely. Sense of normalcy and fun things that they enjoy are great things to do.
Well, we'll have more after the break with Sarah Metz and Mary Pernicki. This is Forum. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Wildfires unleash flames, but also memories, anxieties, fear, and pain. Forum is talking to health experts about the mental and physical toll wildfires take on residents and on first responders, the stress of evacuations, the devastation of losing a home, the strain on firefighters, the worries about your children and whether they're breathing in unhealthy air. All of those mean that you are physically and emotionally impacted by these wildfires, and we want to hear from you. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also post your stories or comments on Facebook, Twitter at KQED Forum, our website, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Are you a fire survivor from the previous wildfires? Is the Kincade Fire bringing things up for you, stirring strong emotions? What are your questions for our guests about wildfire smoke as it travels through the region? And just generally, how are you holding up and turning to others and things for strength. And we're joined by Dr. Mary Prunicki. She's Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at the Sean N. Parker Center for Allergy Research at Stanford University, and Dr. Sarah Metz, Division Director of Trauma Recovery Services at UCSF's Trauma Recovery Center. You know, one of the things that we hear, Sarah Metz, is just that people are being triggered by this fire, the scenes that they're hearing, even if they're not directly impacted by Kincade as a result of having been impacted by previous fires. And when we hear that, we're realizing that it's not so much that we need to recover from just one traumatic event, that we have to continually recover. And so how do we emotionally adapt for resilience in the long term? Because clearly these things are going to keep happening. It almost feels like they're going to be every year.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I think there's other considerations like anniversaries, as well as just the anticipatory anxiety and fear that's happening between the actual fires themselves. And building resiliency is a wonderful question. And, you know, I think social support is such a huge piece. And the prior guest was talking about a woman from the Paradise fires who talked about building a their life around support. And so I think it's really important that folks find self-care activities that help to kind of refill their tank, that help them to feel good, that help them to feel in control, that help them to feel healthy, and that they get the support that they need. If it is formal mental health support, if it is, you know, as a community banding together and figuring out healing activities, rituals that they can build in just to keep themselves connected to one another. It really is very individual for the person and the community, depending on what they need.
If you are isolated, though, mm-hmm. I mean, is there any advice that you give to folks who are isolated and not able to engage with a community or a support group?
That's such a good question. You know, I think technology could really be a support system. And what I mean by that is things like Skype, if they have access to Zoom meetings, social media, that there are ways, I think, that folks can be connected, even if not physically present with one another. If technology is not accessible, writing letters, sending cards, you know, just finding activities in their local area that help them to feel good.
Thank you. We're joined now by Mike Ming. He's Deputy Chief of Employee Support Services and a firefighter, started as a volunteer in 1991 and then in 1994 with CAL FIRE. Welcome to the program, Mike Ming.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you being here because I understand that you have teams deployed right now during the Kincade Fire among firefighters who are battling the blaze.
Yeah, that's correct. We have our peer support trailer set up at the Kincade Fire, and we've done it for the past 5 years on all the CAL FIRE major incidents. And these are folks that are peer trained on my team and also throughout the state that are trained in peer support, and we gather them. Just like the mobilization of engines and aircraft and all the other things, we bring in a peer support team to the incident. We use an old military model called PI, proximity, immediacy, and expectancy. We want to be there on site whenever there's something going on and help them immediately. And then there's an expectancy that if we get there early and often, that we're going to help them process their traumas and griefs and help them to get back to their families, which they're wanting to do so badly.
So can you give us a sense of what firefighters are going through while they're on the line?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, I don't know the doctor's name, but I love the fact of talking about anniversaries and triggers and things of that nature, because of the past 3 to 5 years, the extreme fire behavior that's been going on, that we've been all first responders, law enforcement, even the utility companies, everybody that's out there on the front line, it stores in our body. And so if we've gone through a traumatic incident for 3 to 5 years ago and we continue to do this over and over again, basically what we see is a threat to our personal safety. We see the death and the destruction out there and in monumental cases over the past 3 years. And it goes on and on and on. So we go out there and we're in long-term duration deployments, not unlike military deployments, which are more of like a year, but the military has a start and a stop time. And so when we're out there, we have a start time, which is immediate, and we don't have any real warning up front. And so we'll go out there, and we'll be there for sometimes 40, 60 days. We have no idea when the end is going to come. We watch weather and things of that nature. And during that time, we do 24 on, 24 off. But we are really pretty tired as we go in this very cycle. And so the sleep deprivation, which is something that my team and we're going to be looking into and research, is the sleep deprivation and that effect on our body and as it relates to post-traumatic stress injury and things of that nature. So what's going on out there right now is a lot of adrenaline and cortisol when the firefight is really active, but the long duration work for everybody and the day in and day out, it really takes a toll on the fatigue. And most importantly, we're away from our families. And when we do that, that is very, very difficult for us on a personal level. Now, in my case, I was also evacuated. I live in Occidental in West Sonoma County, so I had to get my family out and then actually respond and go to work. And I was actually on the fire line, and that was same as true for the Tubbs fire back in 2 years ago. It was the same thing. It was a fire in my backyard, as it were. And I responded to it operationally, but I was also thinking about my family who was in that fire's path. And thankfully, the wind died down that next morning, so it didn't continue to the coast.
So then what are some of the specific strategies or tactics that you do to try to at least initially address some of these immediate emotions, issues with sleep deprivation and things like that for the team that's out there?
So that's a great question. So the outreach and education early and often for firefighters, first responders within their career. It's a relatively new thing to outreach and educate about resiliency, breathing techniques, meditation, mindfulness, you know, even yoga to help rebalance our central nervous system. And then the science behind what's going on for our brains, the amygdala, hippocampus, the cortex, prefrontal cortex, and in our adrenal fatigue, all of those things up front and early, just like how to pull some hose or how to cut somebody out of a car in vehicle accidents, we need to be able to give these folks the personal protective tools early and often. So that's the number one thing that we're doing to deploy to all of our folks within CAL FIRE and interagency cooperation as well. But here at the fire, it's almost like it's a reactive measure. So somebody's going to go out. We have an IWI, which is an incident within an incident, a serious injury or a death or a near miss for burnovers and things of that nature because it's a dangerous job. They can come in and we can be asked to go check on, let's say, a strike team. And we can go and we can sit with them. And it's just a tool. It's called critical incident stress management. We can do one-on-ones with them and we can do group crisis intervention. So we can do those types of things. We can just sit and let them tell their story. And then also we can educate them about all of the different resources that are out there. Well, currently right now at the incident base up on the Kincaid Fire, not only do we have peer supporters, interagency peer supporters from local, federal, and state governments, we actually have brought on culturally competent clinicians. And those culturally competent clinicians, and what that means is psychologists, MFTs, LCSWs that come on board with us and work with us under the peer support trailer, and they are immediately available. So we can bring professional help directly to these folks. So if a peer support is the first line of defense, we can refer them to our professional psychologist right there in the trailer, right there at incident base, and have a nice space, safe container for them to talk and actually do modalities like EMDR and brain spotting and things of that nature so that we get to the issue up front and early.
Well, it sounds
so that's basically it, yeah.
It sounds like you're very well resourced, but has that always been the case? I mean, I know recently there was some legislation passed to try to get more of these services to people.
Yeah, sure. So it hasn't always been the case. This is we have broken through CAL FIRE. We have broken through what was termed as a stigma to seek help because early on, and I was even taught this, if you seek help, it's a sign of weakness. But that's not true. And so we realize that we're humans, and so we're building out this program, and that's why I'm honored to be a part of this, leading this program for CAL FIRE, statewide program, is that we are actually bringing the behavioral health and all of these things to the forefront, and it is absolutely a priority for us, especially for Chief Porter. This is a priority for him as the employees and families are our most precious resource, and without us being whole, we can't go out there and protect the you know, the life and property, as we are sworn to do. But the legislation you talk about is AB 1116, California Firefighter Peer Support and Crisis Referrals Act. Basically, what it does is it defines peer support teams. It has specific training requirements to meet the intent of the law. And the bottom line of it is it creates a safe container, again, for confidential communications between peer support and the firefighters out there. There's things that are exceptions, like mandatory reporting requirements, child abuse, suicide, or homicide, those types of things that we have to talk about. But this protects the communication between the peer support member who has the training and the firefighter or the particular employee for the agency that's seeking the help out from peer support.
What happens when firefighters are injured? We've heard about firefighter injuries in the Kincade Fire now. Does that affect morale? Is that a particularly vulnerable time?
Sure. Anytime that we see death or destruction or injury to the public, that is one thing, and it's very horrible. But when we actually see one of our peers, one of our folks that we're working side by side with, who we've known maybe for years, go down for some sort of an injury, I don't know if it affects morale to a certain point. Obviously, it would in the background. But what it does is it actually kind of raises your awareness. And now not only are you in this firefight, but you have this real personal effect of being curious about whether or not your partner is okay. And so that can distract us to a certain degree. And that goes right back to our training. We were taught to compartmentalize our feelings and go towards the fire or go towards any of these horrific incidents that we're trying to mitigate. And if we were emotionally overwhelmed, we couldn't do our job, so we compartmentalize them. But what we really need to do is when we're done and the adrenaline and the cortisol is worn off, that we're taking care of ourselves and we're diving right back into what those feelings and emotions were and speaking about it, so we don't shove those down deep, you know, and never address them again, because that's how we get to post-traumatic stress injury, or it's at least a part of it, you know, an injury to our brain.
I know you need to leave us soon, but speaking about down the line, you know, I have read that there can be long-term impacts like nightmares, a sense of fear, or even guilt among firefighters who have been in these really high-stress situations. Did you experience this? What led you to this work?
So that's a great question. Back in 1991, when I was a volunteer, I was exposed to critical incident stress management, and I had a lot of these mentors. Back then, and this is what the scene was: these brave men that were mentors of mine that actually ran a call, and we had a crisis intervention, and they broke down and started crying, and that really took me aback. And I said, "Whoa! If I'm going to get into this service, I better watch out for the emotional piece of it." So all along my career, I actually had watched the emotional side of myself and what I was doing, and also the crews that I was getting into. And then, you know, I'm not perfect. I'm a fallible human being. So all these things, these stressors, I've actually lived it. You know, I have gone through a divorce and all of those things. So I've sought therapy for at least 20 years, and I've developed the tools that would help me, number one, to make myself whole. And let me look at myself and what I contribute to not only my family but to my community. So I have to be whole. The only thing I can do for you is to work on myself. So I've done a lot of that work. Again, I'm not perfect, but I've done a lot of that work, and I found myself sitting in this space where it's like, wow, this is actually good thing to know, these experience and knowledge that I have, and I'd like to push that forward and help out my folks in not only CAL FIRE but interagency cooperations and building out these peer support teams. So it's a real personal journey for me, and I'm very honored and proud to be a part, leading the pack of my my teammates in CAL FIRE and also all throughout California and the nation, in fact, on this peer support team deal.
Yes. Well, we really appreciate you taking a moment to give us a sense of what first responders are going through and what firefighters specifically are going through. And it sounds like you're saying some of the stigma around seeking support has improved.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely improved. No longer do we find folks saying, hey, suck it up, buttercup, would be the phrase. People, especially after the last 3 to 5 years, folks understand that even 30-year, you know, long-in-the-tooth captains are coming into our office and saying, hey, this just brought me to my knees and never thought it would happen. So what really people are realizing is that, you know what, we're human beings and we're susceptible to these traumas and these griefs, and we've got to be able to take care of ourselves. The younger generation coming in through, we're hitting them up hard up front, and we're outreach and education and giving them all this information, and so they're accepting it and saying, you know, that this is just a part of what we do. Whereas when I started, you know, back in 1991, except for my exception of being exposed to CISM, it was this is what we do, is we shove it down and we don't talk about it. But that's no longer the case, and we are breaking through that, and we're making it a human process now.
Before you go, we did just have a listener ask a question related to prisoner firefighters. Tim asks, what about the prisoner firefighters? Do the prisoners get the same mental health support as CAL FIRE people?
So they have the California Department of Corrections. They have their own they have their own system of therapists and psychologists and things of that nature that they can go through, and that's a resource for them. However, in times of, I think, 5 years ago on the King Fire, I was, you know, fresh into the program and fires thereafter. If we have some of our crews, and you say the inmate fire crews, that have gone through a traumatic event, we'll do the same thing with them. We'll bring them into a group, and we'll do a group crisis intervention with them. And I've led several with the inmate crews because, again, we're all humans, and when tragedy strikes, we come together as a community. I don't know, it doesn't matter what your background is, everybody gets their slate is wiped clean, and everybody finds their heart and their mind, and we become one. So it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, in order we have to take care of each other, and that means everybody within all communities. And so, yes, we do provide that for the inmate fire crews as well.
Firefighter Mike Ming, Deputy Chief of Employee Support Services at CAL FIRE. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for having us. I really appreciate you helping us bring this this most important topic to the awareness of everybody.
Thank you. And thanks to our listeners who are continuing with their questions and comments. And again, 866-733-6786 is the number, or you can always post them on Facebook, Twitter, or our website. And Kate writes, can you speak to the experiences of those of us who aren't directly impacted by the fires, but are who are still feeling scared, anxious, and emotionally overwhelmed? I'm in Oakland, where we have power and no fires, but I have friends affected by the fires and know several firefighters on duty. I keep feeling like I shouldn't feel so anxious because others are truly suffering and I'm quote-unquote fine. I know that's not entirely rational, but I suspect it's a common feeling for those of us in the Greater Bay Area and California. Sarah Metz?
Yeah, I think that word "I shouldn't" is really dangerous. You're going to feel what you're feeling, and your feelings are very valid. And when you have loved ones, when you are in proximity of danger, when you are a empathic and compassionate person, of course you're going to be impacted when your community is at risk. So I think you get yourself into a bind when you start saying, I shouldn't feel this way, rather than acknowledging what you feel, taking care of yourself. Those feelings can be really helpful to motivate you to figure out how to support other people, and also to normalize for other folks that even if you're not there, you can be impacted. And I think it's also common for folks, you mentioned earlier around this idea of like survivor guilt. So people can frequently feel, well, why am I okay and they're not okay? And that can cause a lot of complex reactions as well.
Well, Jennifer asks, I'm fortunate to have a good indoor air purifier and an air quality monitor, which also shows the level of CO2 inside. The more I lower the particulate matter in the house, the CO2 level increases. How dangerous is this? The only way to bring in oxygen is to bring in smoke. I don't know what to do. Mary Prunicki, do you have any thoughts for Jennifer?
Well, without knowing what type of air purifier she has, it would be hard to answer that. There are certain air purifiers which are ozone generating, and so that might be a concern. Mm. But again, I think there's a few good resources online to help choose the right type of air purifier so that the particulate matter and other pollutants indoors is being taken care of correctly.
And again, that resource is...
Well, the EPA actually has something online, and also the California Air Resources Board has something online to help choose air purifiers.
Well, let me go next to Chris in Modesto. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you so much for all the great information you're putting out in. My question is about, we have friends of ours who we've been...
Very sorry about that, Chris. I believe the end of his comment here, our producer who screened the call says he actually wanted to know whether nasal irrigation was helpful. Dr. Barry Prunicki, are you with us still?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, saline irrigation may be helpful. It will help remove, you know, the cilia in your nose is helping to filter some of the larger particles. And so certainly flushing your nasal passages with saline may be provide some relief.
And also bathing frequently, if you can, is my understanding that that helps to get some of that particulate matter off your clothing and other places where it can linger.
Right, correct. It might decrease, problems with eczema or itching. It certainly will help somewhat given the exposures.
Well, Alan writes, if parents are showing distress and confusion, children who need their help will amplify that anxiety and fear. Adults can show leadership and delegate tasks to the youngsters, giving them something to occupy their time, support each other, stay informed and focused, which can be difficult, and let the little things go. Lisa writes, my family evacuated this past Friday to get away from the fire and smoke with our toddler. Now, the night before another big wind event, one of our employers is demanding we return to work today, even though Calistoga is currently under an advised evacuation and we have a red flag warning. This is such a scary situation to be put in, to risk losing a job or having to go back to our home that is only a few miles from the Kincade Fire in Calistoga. I mean, the economic stressors of this, Sarah Metz, are, you know, can't be underestimated.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When folks can't go to work, their entire routine is thrown off. When they have a family, their routine is thrown off. They're worried about caring for themselves. They're worried about caring for their children. And that's basic needs. And our basic needs require money. And so when there's those pressures and pulls in terms of keeping your family safe versus keeping a job, but keeping a job also keeps your family safe, it can be very difficult to navigate that.
Well, Rain writes, as a therapist working with clients who have PTSD, I see a need for information about both danger and safety with regard to wildfires. While information on the dangers of wildfires is critically important, I think the media has a responsibility to avoid sensationalist reporting so as not to trigger unnecessary trauma in people who are already emotionally overactivated. And Steve writes, it might be time for the state of California to adjust its elementary and high school's curriculums to prepare children for the new norm of fire and other disasters. We should teach the necessary skills for coping, survival, and connecting with their communities for aid, protection, and communication. Again, this is Sarah Metz sort of looking ahead, recognizing that this is, you know, when you talk about trauma recovery, being re-triggered can be a bit of a setback, right? And so what we are looking at is a situation where we will likely have continual reminders and triggers and just a new normal with regard to wildfires. Are there any conversations, in the community of physicians that you are working with about how to deal with these ongoing issues?
That's a really great question. You know, my context is a little bit different. The context that I can speak to is, for example, mass shootings, which I know is not what we're talking about. But because there have been so many mass shootings, you know, there are different trainings in schools. There's different conferences that happen to prepare all kinds of responders for how to deal with this. And so I don't see why this would be any different, which is, you know, really preparing the community and equipping folks with the resources that they need.
Well, Jake asks, what about long-term health risks from the smoke? Even in Oakland, some of us have been breathing in smoke for weeks at a time, years in a row. Mary Prunicki, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but what can you tell Jake about, you know, breathing in smoke for weeks at a time, years in a row?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, with regards to wildfire smoke exposure, there's not a lot of research to say, you know, how impactful this will be long-term for our health. Most of the research has focused on air pollution, and we know, you know, more of the long-term consequences of that. But these, you know, short bursts of elevated particulate matter levels, it's just, we're actively researching that. But, you know, in a healthy individual, we just don't know long-term what the consequences will be.
Well, so if you're a relatively healthy person, then is it likely that your body will be able to just deal with it and you'll be okay? Or is, if you have gone through the process of breathing in a lot of smoke, have, you know, felt that terrible and consistent sort of tickle constantly, or felt like shortness of breath, have you ultimately done a little bit of permanent damage to yourself?
Well, we certainly hope not. We are currently and actively researching that, looking at healthy individuals who are exposed short-term to the wildfire smoke, mm-hmm. and then looking months later to see if we see, you know, changes in your immune system, your blood pressure, and things like that. We simply don't know. You know, it's our guess that for healthy individuals, you know, there won't be any long-term impacts from this. But, you know, the research just hasn't been done yet.
Well, let me see if I can get one last call from Bill in here. Bill and Martinez, what would you like to share?
Hi, I'd just like to thank the chief from Cal Fire, Chief Ming, talking about peer support. I was in Vietnam when I was 18, and I was a firefighter on the Oakland Tunnel Fire back in 91, and I'm still having nightmares. So I'm really encouraged to see this kind of mental health counseling taking place.
Well, thank you for ending on that positive note. And Sarah Metz, if there's last word to you in terms of people who are coping with this and will be for some time now.
I think just don't be afraid to share how you're feeling and what you need and getting the support that you need.
Dr. Sarah Metz, Division Director of Trauma Recovery Services at UCSF, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Mary Prunicki, Director of Air Pollution and Health Research at Stanford, really appreciate you being with us as well.
Thank you so much.
And thank you to our listeners for their questions, comments, and for sharing their stories and experiences. And just a quick note from Marin County officials who just want to remind people that if they are in any kind of emergency, texting 911 is possible even if cell service is out. So that is one emergency resource that's out there as well. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.